Hi, everyone. Andy Klein with you for this Friday edition of A Juno Afternoon. Today, we're going to be getting a preview of the Friday Fireside Lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center with Kensington General Manager Mark Kiesling. Also going to be learning about what it takes to put on a stage play here in Juno at Perseverance Theater. James Sullivan and Frank Delaney are going to tell us all about maybe the fighting side of theater. Also, we're going to find out about Juno Community Cafe on Opioids that's coming up. And Kathy Ruddy will be here to highlight Saturday's Coffee and Collections this week, featuring a history lesson about the Princeton Hall. That's all coming up, plus Bird Note and more right here. Stay tuned right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Northern Arapaho Tribe on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming plans to begin self-insuring its tribal employees, ending its federal employee health benefits program. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, some say it's not a good time to do that.
Northern Arapaho member Andrea Clifford is the former assistant manager of the Wind River Casino. She says 10 years ago, the casino, which is owned by the Northern Arapaho, attempted self-insuring. Federal law requires health care providers who take Medicare to offer Native Americans lower rates like the ones Medicare offers. But she says the casino ended up in court because private providers argued the law didn't apply to them.
Well, even though you're going to the hospital for, let's say, an MRI, I mean, you get billed for the radiologist portion of that, and they're private. And so we got pushback from them, and they said, no, the law doesn't apply to us.
Clifford says her tribe needs to slow down and get more public input.
Maybe 6 months down the road or maybe next year, maybe. But I think they still have a lot of groundwork to be doing.
Matt Silverstein is CEO of First Nation Health Insurance, which already works on the Eastern Shoshone's self-insurance program, the other tribe on Wind River Reservation. He says many tribes are moving toward self-insuring.
At all of the tribes across the country that any tribal member thinks of as successful or well-operated, all of them have a self-funded program. Not some of them. All of them.
He says only 3 in 10 Arapaho employees are participating in the federal insurance, one of the lowest rates in the country.
By contrast, the Eastern Shoshone tribe has more than twice as high of a participation rate by their employees, and they're paying a fraction of what the Arapaho are paying.
The Northern Arapaho plan to start self-insuring in April. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards in Laramie.
The Miccosukee tribe has returned a newborn baby to her parents. The baby was taken by tribal police over the weekend, just days after birth, at a Florida hospital off the reservation. The Miami Herald reports a tribal hearing was held Thursday, and the court agreed to return the child to Rebecca Sanders and Justin Johnson. Sanders, who's Miccosukee, says the custody battle is with the maternal grandmother. The tribe cites safety concerns for the baby as the reason for the removal. The parents are being accused of domestic violence, but have reportedly denied those allegations. Authorities are investigating what happened in the case of the baby being seized from the hospital. Jurisdiction questions are among those being raised. Navajo leaders are applauding the U.S. Senate's passage of the Ashland Mike Amber Alert and Indian Country Act. If signed into law, it would make tribes eligible for federal grants to help them implement the Amber Alert system. The bill is named after a Navajo girl who was abducted and murdered on the Navajo reservation in 2016. The bill is being sent to President Trump. Navajo leaders say they will urge the president to sign it into law. The Amber Alert legislation was one of 6 bills for Indian Country to clear the Senate this week. Others involve areas in education and economic development. Those bills now go to the House for consideration. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is continuing to meet with tribes to discuss the Trump administration's plan to address opioid abuse. Zinke was in Washington State Thursday. He met with the Spokane and Colville tribes and is expected to meet next with the Lummi Nation. The Trump administration has announced steps to tackle opioid addiction and overdose in the U.S. through education, treatment, and law enforcement. Zinke met with the tribes in Arizona and Wisconsin earlier this week. Tribal leaders have welcomed the meetings, yet say consultation needs to continue, especially when developing plans for Indian Country. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
We are all related is the theme of the 7th Biennial Vision Maker Film Festival returning to Lincoln, Nebraska, April 20th to the 26th. Info at visionmakermedia.org. Vision Maker Media is proud to support this show.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
KTOO is supported by listeners like you and by Breezen, offering a large selection of wine, beer, and spirits at 3 Juneau locations. The Growler Station at the Lemon Creek Breezen carries rotating draft beers from Alaska and the U.S. Information at breezen.com.
Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. Andy Klein with you on this beautiful and not-so-windy Friday afternoon, thank goodness. And Mark Kiesling is here with me. Mark, thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet.
Mark's the general manager out at Kensington, and you've got a fireside lecture that you're doing tonight. Those are at 6:30 and 8 o'clock out at the Visitor Center. So pretty interesting. You've been there for a few years and maybe become a little bit of a student of the history of the mine out there?
Yeah, a little bit. You have to be a student of the history of all mines when you get involved in them. And
is that right? Just because? Why is that?
Well, the geology dictates why the mine is there, but those claims and all those little operations that are around there are indications of future ore deposits. And so as a mining company, once you have one and you start developing on it, you begin to look at where other people mined and evaluate those to see if those are going to be prospective for in the future.
Kensington has an interesting history, right, because gold was discovered there many, many years ago. It was an operating gold mine, and then it wasn't for a long time. So tell me about when it was first discovered gold out there, what years that was, and how that developed.
You bet. So after gold was discovered here in Juneau, the prospectors started to move north, and about late 1880s, they discovered gold on the Lynn Canal side. So that we call that the Comet side of the mountain. And that was the Northern Lights claim. And so it was a very prospective claim, and those two gentlemen, they brought in a mill. I think it was 6 months later they had a mill up and running and started to produce their first gold ounces out of there.
And what year would that have been?
That would have been 1896. So 1895, they staked their claims, and in 1896, January or February of 1896, they had their mill up and running. So real fast.
Wow. Was it a big operation?
It was a really, really small operation.
Okay.
In fact, they had a hard time keeping up with their mill. I think their mill only ran it was very few days out of the year. They were carrying the ore down off the mountain, very steep terrain. They were carrying it down by hand.
Okay.
Packing it out, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And about 2 years later, a snowslide came and took the mill building out and shut their operation down. But by that time, more industrious businessmen with better backing, better financial backing, came up there and started buying up claims and started up the Berners Bay Mining Company. Now, that's all on the Comet side. We're actually, we started out on the Joellen side, and that's part of the ore body that we're after. And on the Joellen side, claim staking started up around that same exact time. And the Joellen mine came into production, I'm going to scratch my memory here, but it was in the late 1890s, 95, 96, and continued operation up until about 1928. And that's the side where we're located at right now.
And then it stopped in 28, and then there just wasn't gold production out there for a number of years. Is that right?
Yeah. So the war and water shut the Joellen mine down, and it was one of the best producing mines out there. And it shut that mine down, and that was 1917. In 1919, they tried to start the mine back up again, and it just they struggled with water and financials. At the time, they poured $900,000 into the mine, which is equivalent to about $23 million today.
Right.
And they got about a third of that back in payback.
When you say water, what do you mean by that? Water was infiltrating
in the mine, yeah. So they had their underground workings, and in their workings, the water was coming in so quickly that they couldn't get the water out. They didn't have the pumping capacity to get that water out. I was reading some estimates of 200 gallons a minute is what they were they were trying to get out of the mine.
So how does it work? There's a mine there. There's a claim. Is there a procedure where that claim has to kind of go dormant in order for someone else to come in and restake? Or how does that work?
No. You can sell a claim. Somebody can buy the claim from somebody else. And that's a lot of what happened back then, is people would buy up the claims from other folks. The reason why it went dormant for so long, of course, was it was really investment and trying to attract somebody there. From about 1920 to 1928 and even beyond 1928, there was a lot of marketing documentation trying to market Jewellen to prospective investors, but nobody would bite.
Mm-hmm.
And it really wasn't until the 1980s that people started to become more interested in those claims again. And Coeur started getting involved in about 87 and really started moving things forward in the 90s.
So this modern gold mining that's happening out there, what does that look like?
So modern gold mining is way different than the historic stuff. So today we use really high precision equipment. We're doing all our miners are sitting inside of cabs, not all of them, but most of our miners are sitting inside of cabs, nice air conditioning. They might have an MP3 player in there or some other music device playing for them. And we're able to provide a much safer environment for those folks, a really safe environment. And then we have things like automated muckers. That's one of the things that we're looking at right now. A mucker is an underground mining loader.
Okay.
That loads the ore.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking at automation and those things where we can take the miner actually out of the mine and put them up in a chair in a nice comfortable office where they can have a cup of coffee, maybe a plate of breakfast, and still be operating a machine underground.
And so the mine, if you were to go up to the mine, what does the kind of entrance to the mine look like?
You can drive right into it. So we call the entrance a portal. And it's about 20 feet wide, and it's about 17 feet tall. And you can drive a pickup truck. In fact, that's how we access it. We drive a pickup truck right into it, or you can drive a big haul truck in and out of it.
And does it go all the way through the mountain?
It does. Yep.
So it comes. It you can see Lynn Canal on the other side.
Yes,
is that
you
right?
Can.
Wow.
Yep. So we have we actually have three portals. We have two main portals for the Kensington deposit, and then we have a third portal on the Jewellen ore body. To the south of the Kensington Main.
Now, this is all. I recently saw a map that showed geology kind of the area, and it was really interesting to me that there's this one big, huge chunk of landmass, right, that got shoved into Southeast Alaska. That's kind of responsible for all of the major gold. Is that? Do I kind of have that right? That there's this one kind of unusual. Everything else surrounding Southeast Alaska is kind of this other geographic kind of makeup, and then there's this one big, huge section. Am I kind of describing that correctly?
Yeah. There was the main continent of North America, and like you said, there were slivers and other pieces of land that were brought up and smushed and smeared against the continent of North America, which makes up a lot of Southeast Alaska.
Right.
And actually north up towards Anchorage, too, it's the same sort of thing.
Yeah. So does that have a name, that one kind of big landmass, or is there when it just seems like that's the area that when you see all the successful mines that got developed turn of the century, they were kind of looking around in this. They didn't quite know that that's what they were doing at the time. They were just following what was rich and what wasn't in gold, especially.
Yeah, and mineralization a lot of times is associated with structure in the rock, basically faults and breaks in the rock. And so that's really what's going on. There's a lot of faults and breaks in the rock right here, which are allowing fluids and other things to bring the mineralization deposited.
Okay. And that's why gold is found with quartz often and that kind of thing, right? Because it's this crystalline structure to it that then allows for this kind of pure gold to be kind of dispersed throughout it.
Yeah, and we're not always mining pure gold. We do have some actual what we call coarse native gold in this Jewellen ore body to the south, but a lot of what Kensington is gold mixed in with pyrite or fool's gold.
Okay. So when you see fool's gold, maybe you're on the right track.
You might be.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. That's a cool thing. Not such a fool after all. Well, tell me a little bit more about some of the things that you talk about during your lecture. You get into the history and then some of the kind of nuts and bolts about how the mind works.
Yeah, I go into some of the nuts and bolts on how the mind works. I talk a bit about camp life and what it's like to be a miner living at a camp. Mining's changed certainly from what it was 100 years ago. 100 years ago, it was large, literally man camps. And now we have a varied camp. We have both men and women working together out at the camp. We have a full kitchen. We have housing for almost 300 people. So we've got a pretty good sized camp, a modern port facility, and bringing all of our materials in and out.
How many people are out there at any one time working?
So just our folks would be about 220 people.
Wow, I didn't really realize it was that many people, like, on-site working.
Yeah, and then you can have, and that's because we run a day shift and a night shift. We run 24 hours, 7 days a week. And then you can have you will have contractors out there.
Sure.
So we've got a pretty good-sized contract workforce also.
Yeah, wow, it's an amazing thing to think about that history that's there. You said you have a lot of historic photos as well?
Yeah, a lot maybe being five or six.
Sure.
But
okay.
Yeah.
So what when you find or have seen these historic photos, what is it about, what do you see that's like such a major difference, or what is it, you know, what are some of the things you see that go, oh man, I had no idea that's what was going on?
Yeah, what I really pull out of those things is you look at kind of the mine, you look at the drift size, and the drift size is very, very small. We're talking about, you know, 6 foot by 8 foot drifts. You're looking at very small areas. And
what's a drift?
A drift is that's a mine working. So
okay.
So the mine workings will be about 6 foot or 6 foot by 8 foot, and they'll use a lot of timbered support. We don't use any timbers really in our mine operation. We use steel bolts.
So the mines then, I mean, that are almost that stereotypical, when we think of a mine, right, seven dwarves going down the mine, it's really looked like that then. That's
yeah,
what it
really
looked
did.
Like that. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and they had, you know, water conveyance. They had wooden water conveyance where we're using pipes and those sorts of things. If you think about when I look at those mines, I see the powerhouse. One of those photos really snaps into my mind. So they had the first semi-diesel power generation powerhouse in Alaska.
Wow.
Was there at the Joellen mine. The Comet mine had the first narrow-gauge railroad in Alaska. So
much of the innovation that happened in Juneau, I mean, all the electricity and all that stuff and these high alpine lake taps that were, you know, not done anywhere else was because mining needed that power, right? I mean, that was the thing.
Yeah, that's correct. And those people were constantly innovating. Not only were they working really hard, but they were constantly innovating, trying to find solutions to their problems.
Yeah, right. All for gold.
All for gold.
Right. They had that fever. Well, fascinating to think about it. Obviously, the history of mining completely tied in with the history of Juneau and of Alaska. So a big part of our history and a big part of what's happening today. Mark Kiesling, thanks so much for coming in. General Manager at Kensington, you're doing two lectures tonight, one at 6:30, one at 8 o'clock, talking all about the history of the gold mining, Kensington Gold Mine, and also about kind of what are the operations are looking like out there today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it. the Allman Brothers there playing Elizabeth Reed. And we've got James Sullivan and Frank Delaney here from Perseverance Theater. Thanks for coming in, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Andy.
We wanted to just talk about, number one, we're going to talk about Cyrano de Bergerac, which is on stage right now, but a kind of, in some ways you might watch that and not realize how complicated it is to put on a show like that, right? I mean, there's all kinds of action, there's all kinds of stuff going on. So tell me a little bit about when you approach a show like Cyrano, what are some of the elements you're looking at about going, okay, boy, we got to make sure we got these things in line.
I imagine most theatergoers don't realize that we start actually just about every show, not even something as large with a large cast like Cyrano with all its different elements, but we actually start like 5, 6, 7 months in advance right. with the design of the show and all everything that goes into it. We've been working on Cyrano since well into last year. I mean, we started casting 6 months ago. The design, we hired the director, Eleanor Holdridge, who was here earlier, talking about her work about a year in advance. So we've been spending all those months. And then when it starts coming down to crunch time, as we cast everything, we have to put the sound design together. We have to build all that set, put all the music together, do all the costuming for something as elaborate as what Cyrano is. Takes in a lot of time. It's quite a marvel, and it just seems like how do we do? Sometimes I get amazed how we do.
Well,
it's just a handful of people there.
Yeah, you know.
Sometimes only barely.
Just
always gets in under the wire.
Yeah, we're just talking about. I actually got to do sound design in a couple of Perseverance plays, and so I was really fresh eyes looking at that process. And I remember going to the first like read-throughs and going, I don't know, how is this going to happen, right?
Right.
But one thing that you really realize is about professional theater work is how regimented and organized it ends up being. It's
right.
really amazing, actually. It's
yeah.
an incredible team effort, right? And it's a monumental task often to pull these really complicated ones off or any play off.
Right. Our calendar before opening, we work back, you know, 6 weeks before that opening night for something as elaborate as Cyrano. And it is. It's a pretty intense time, especially that week before, as then when we put all the design elements, you know, the actors are working away at night, designers are built, and our crew are building things during the day. And then we all pull it together into the stage space
yeah.
at Perseverance. And, yeah, it really is an intense few weeks.
Now, this play in particular has fights.
That's right.
Right?
It does, yeah.
So that is something you end up doing. You're kind of the fight coordinator on a number of the plays that Perseverance does.
Yeah, and I was fight choreographer for Chad Deity earlier this season.
Which must have been pretty fun, but also pretty complex, right?
It was amazingly fun and complex. A lot of people don't realize how dangerous that type of fighting can actually be. And I also did, years ago, I did fights for Othello. I did a bunch of movement work and some fight stuff for Peter and the Starcatcher. And then on this one, my title is actually Fight Captain. and there were father and son team came in that had worked with Eleanor before. They're based out of New York, the Sordelais, and they came in and they were primary choreographers on this one. And so my job is mostly about refining the fights, making them look better, tightening everything up, and then making sure that, for example, if something goes wrong one night, we've got to figure out why it went wrong, what happened, and figure out how to fix it.
Yeah, and choreographer is really an interesting term because it is about like doing, obviously, the choreographing like a dance.
It is in a lot of ways.
There's
yeah.
certain contact. There's this, as you said, realism. What mm-hmm. are some of the things that you have to keep in mind about how to make a fight look real and still keep it safe?
So that's a very fun question for me because particularly in this show, it's a very swashbuckly style show. So there's a lot of things that don't really have martial application. You know,
right.
they're not sword techniques. They're
right.
fun sword
they
techniques.
They wouldn't really work.
Right. Yeah.
You would be killed.
But they look great.
Right.
And a lot of times, really what it comes down to is angles, you know. And so the unique shape of the Perseverance space makes that a little bit more challenging than some other spaces like a traditional proscenium where the audience is only on one side. And so that's a consideration that has to come in. And then there's a lot of work on targeting, and I refer to it as perceived versus actual targets, what we want the audience to think is being attacked and where we're actually placing the sword and that kind of thing. So there's it's a mix of it's a lot of smoke and mirrors. It's a lot of magic and misdirection,
right,
and that kind of stuff. And then sometimes it's just about we're just far enough away from each other that the sword can't get you, but I react like it's going to.
Yeah, right. And so that reaction is what the audience is reacting to as well. And
exactly.
Then, and then
yeah.
It seems very real. Yeah. Well, it's and then it's an interesting thing to think about. Do you get into a situation where there's actors that can be wonderful, terrific actors, but maybe they just don't have that physicality? Or how do you work around those kinds of elements?
Well, on this show, we didn't really run into that problem too much. Our lead, John, is amazing. He's gung-ho and willing to jump in and try all different kinds of things. But one of the ways that the sword lays work, and I tend to work this way too, is I come in with an idea of how I want the thing to look and mm-hmm. how the story is going to flow. And then if you two are my actors, I'll talk to you and figure out, oh, well, you've got a bad back. All right, well, and you've got bum knees. All right, well, we'll work around
right,
that.
Right.
Can you do this? Okay, well, how about this? And we start building based on, I don't want to say compromise, but it's figuring out what I want, what the director wants, and finding that happy middle where the actor can achieve it safely.
In a typical script, are there cues for this? Are there are there typically directions about exactly how the fight should look? Or is it really up to interpretation every time something's performed?
So in a more modern script, you tend to get more description of the fight. You know, if you look historically, Shakespeare is well known for they fight or exits pursued by bear.
right.
You know, and so there was a lot more open to interpretation than. Honestly, that's a lot easier than, in my opinion, the more modern playwright of what you see a lot these days is he slaps her or she slaps him. And that seems like a really straightforward, simple technique, but that's one of the most complicated hand-to-hand things to do because there are so many things in the face
right.
area that can go wrong. And so you don't really want to do a contact slap. And doing a non-contact slap is a really difficult thing to stage and place. And so sometimes it's about trying to figure out what the author's intent is with that. What feeling, what emotion are they trying to get from the audience with that slap? And is there another way that we can achieve that, another technique, another type of violence?
Are there things when you see a script that is going to describe a certain type of action, I guess I'll ask you two questions. One is, are there ones that you go, oh, boy? And then are there ones where you go, oh, no?
Absolutely. I was lucky enough to work on a production of She Kills Monsters earlier this year, and that's huge in the fight director community, not only because of all of the cool fights that are available in it, but because there's so many opportunities in that for women to fight. Which is fairly unusual, but changing now. And so that's really exciting because, you know, there's a five-headed dragon that is talked about in that and all kinds of fun stuff that doesn't come up in regular plays all that often. But then there's some other plays. I can't remember the name of it right now. But it'll probably come to me in a second. But in that one, the character is supposed to get up on top of a table and change a light bulb and gets electrocuted and is supposed to fall from the table and get caught by the other two people on stage.
Wow. Right? Yeah.
Which is complex. And the time that I did it, the guy who played the man who got electrocuted was over 300 pounds. And the lady was sub 100 pounds, and the gentleman was a tall, skinny guy, probably 150 pounds. So just physics alone, there's no way that that can happen.
Yeah, there'll be a crushing
that
will happen.
that was a short run, whenever that played. One night only.
Well, so that's an oh-no. Yeah. Well, that's
funny. That's part of the theater, and that's why I love working with Frank, is that... We did this in Othello, and I know they did it in Chad Deity, and they're doing it now for Cyrano. Once we choreograph, we go before every show. We review all the fights, any type of physical activity that takes place on stage, even simple things like you'd say, oh, it's just a little slap. You see big sword fights or something, and you think, well, they must have practiced really hard on that, and we do. But I've actually worked at other theaters years ago before I came up to Juno, and it's usually those little simple things, and you think that the director might not take seriously. Say, oh, it's just a little thing here. It's just a little simple kick. Mm-hmm. And then because we didn't work with a fight choreographer, we didn't work it out and put it in the schedule and put that all together. And someone blows out their knee, or someone hurts their arm, and all of a sudden you're like, well, now what do we do?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that can go wrong with simple little techniques.
And the one thing that's struck me when I've been able to go to these tech rehearsals is to see how much directors are concerned with blocking, right? Yeah. Just in normal scenes.
Right.
So then combined with fight. So how do you combine what you need technically with what the director wants visually?
So that it varies a little bit director to director. Some directors will block everything up to the start of the fight and then know where they want the person to get knocked unconscious or whatever, and it has to happen over on here. And then everything in between that is whatever I want to do with
right.
it. And other directors have a much more refined idea, or they don't know what they want until they start seeing things begin to happen, and then we have a dialogue about it. So it's really – my process is never the same – really twice director to director, but it's a very interesting one and a fun one. And like in this one, we've got, so the Perseverance stage is not huge.
No, yeah.
Our set is fairly large, and we've got swords. Everyone's wearing swords and fighting with swords, and they add about 3 feet to the end of an actor's arm. We have one fight that we refer to as the 100-man fight. Right? We don't actually have 100 men.
No, but...
but it sure feels like it.
Yeah, a cast of thousands.
And so when we originally choreographed that, we thought we had a lot more space for it to happen in. And then we got into Tech Week and they started choreographing the set changes, which is another thing that has to be...
huge.
Choreographed and organized, and we got moved to a small section of the stage. So we lost probably a good 10 feet of the space that we had originally planned on, and so we had to start making adjustments. Like, all right, well, that slash that you're doing this way, now you have to hold that in closer to your body, and we're not going to take this step, and you're going to do it like this. But we're still going to sell it the other way,
yeah.
Because now we don't have those extra 2 feet,
right?
And the other big thing, and this affected Eleanor's work as well, is the guys are carrying the swords most of the show, and so that's 2 feet sticking out behind them that can be hard to remember is there. So there was a long period where everybody was running into everyone else's swords. And then when we moved into the space, there was a period where I had to keep reminding people that there would be people in the front row.
Oh,
and
right.
You've got to pay attention to that. And everybody has done a great job of learning how to control their rooster tail, is what we call
yeah.
it.
Right.
And so last night we had, it wasn't a full house, but mostly full house. And those front row seats were full, and I'm happy to say that everyone reports that they felt engaged and in the middle of the action, but they never felt like they were going to get poked with a sword. So that's a win.
That's a win. That is a good goal.
See, now with my marketing hat add on. But we should charge extra for those fun rides.
I think
you should.
Like Gallagher.
Yeah, you get exactly the Gallagher effect.
You get a hockey mat and a front row seat. There you go. Well, let's just touch a little bit. Thanks so much. That's so interesting to kind of just delve in a little bit on the fight portion of a show like this. But tell me a little bit more. What's the run of Cyrano?
It's running right now. It'll run through April 14th. We have that's a Saturday night. So it's we've got three more weeks going on. It's running Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 7:30. We have a couple more Sunday matinees. So look at our website. The Sunday matinees are at 4. We're lucky enough we're going to be able to do a couple of student matinees during the week. Once those kids go back to school after spring break is over, well, a few of them we'll get them on a bus and pack them in. And I'm really excited about that.
That'll be fun.
There just aren't that many opportunities to do a huge, big, classic play like this.
Right.
I know Perseverance, we do one at the most once a year, and we do maybe one every other year like that. And to do a big, wonderful, poetic love story like this,
swashbuckling and all that,
some swords, and there's a war that goes on in the
That's
second
a proper
act.
Play.
It is. It's got a little everything in there. We've got poets, people throwing food at each other. We've got everything happening in this one.
There is literally something for everyone in this play.
Yeah.
It is epic in the old sense of the word.
Yeah.
So we'll don't get to do too many of those. It's exciting.
And then just shortly, what other stuff coming up? Are there fun things happening at Perseverance?
There's always too much going on at Perseverance. We have our young company starts up in a couple weeks. We're having we just finished up our spring break camp for kids. We have three different classes going on for different age groups, from little kids to more middle school age, after school. So go to our website and check out Young Company and sign up. We're doing an adaptation of Neil Gaiman's Norse mythology, a collection of stories based on the Norse myths. And I'm really excited to see that. Yeah, we got some. Hopefully, we'll have some kids sign up for that. It's only Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday after school, and then there'll be some performances in late May before school gets out. That'll be going on. We're selling raffle tickets.
All right.
Let me tell you, Andy, you're not going to win one if you don't buy one.
I don't know. Yes. Okay.
We're selling those. And we've already announced next season. Like I said at the beginning of this thing, we spend months planning these shows out, and we've got next season already lined up for next year starting out. It's a great season we have in store with a couple original plays coming out, a big musical, Guys and Dolls in the Spring. We open with an original Alaskan piece called Whale Song, Inupiaq play. Really excited about that, and we'll follow that with the American classic Our Town. There's a lot going on.
Sounds great.
We're already starting meetings. We've already got on the calendar.
Yeah,
so
it rolls on. Well, James and Frank, thanks so much for coming in, telling us, informing us, and educating us about the intricacies of putting on a fight scene like what happens in Cyrano de Bergerac. And James, thanks for coming in and letting us know all about what's happening at Perseverance. It's going to be a great show tonight.
People
still get there
all
tonight.
Weekend.
Yeah, all weekend long, Cyrano de Bergerac playing at Perseverance Center. Thanks for both of you for coming in. Coming up, here's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. We're about to hear the song of the gray-breasted wood wren in the mountains of southern Mexico. The song's being sung not by a single bird, but by a mated pair. The two wrens are singing a duet. Each sings a different phrase, but the phrases are so closely linked, we hear it as one song. Such close duet singing in birds is called antiphonal song. The pairs use song to stake out and hold breeding territories. Duetting is most typical of birds, including many tropical wrens, that live in dense habitats. We think close interplay of song reinforces pair bonds in birds that frequently lose sight of each other. Let's slow down the song to 1/4 speed. It'll be easier to hear two separate voices.
Thank you.
Bird songs featured on BirdNote come from the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. I'm Michael Stein.
Support comes from Alaska Litho, dedicated to delivering personal customer service to Southeast Alaska businesses for 70 years. Alaska Litho uses innovative technology to support businesses. More information about their print, social media, and website services at aklitho.com.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you, and Kathy Ruddy and Marie Darlin has joined me here in the studio. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate
Thanks for the invite.
You're both here because there's going to be a coffee and collections happening, and tell me a little bit about what's going to be talked about.
Well, coffee and collections is City Museum. That's not
That's not this.
That's not the Historical Society.
Okay, that's not the Historical Society. Okay,
no.
So tell me about what's happening.
Well,
I have the wrong notes here in front of me. I'm sorry.
The Historical Society has been around for many, many years because I've been a member for I don't know how long. But anyway, we try to do once or twice, sometimes three times a year, some type of a program that's informational and yet, you know, interesting to people in Juneau. Last year, we didn't have much luck because every topic that we were going to use, somebody else already had a program on. That's the way it is in Juneau at times, you
right.
know. And so, but we always have a specific program for our October or November meeting night, which is a dinner at the Baranoff with some kind of a speaker and a program. And we've had several of those. I mean, well, every year we have some type of a program there. But then it's, as I say, trying to find another topic then for another program. And we were very lucky when one of our members came back from over in Sitka and said, there's a program that we need to do here. So that's how we came about to using this program.
Okay.
And we have a couple of other ideas in mind for, say, maybe next fall or something. And once again, then we are trying not to conflict with some of the other historical things that are going to be going on next fall. So all I can say is please stay tuned. And the next one that goes out will not have the wrong month on it, which
oh.
we did this time. And we didn't run it by enough faces or
proofreaders or
to be sure that it was correct when it went out. So of course then we had to send the other one out to be sure that they knew it was March, not April.
So let's get the date and time and all that.
Well,
right?
It's going to be tomorrow afternoon from 1 to 4 over at APK, the State Museum. And we are very lucky that now we do have that availability over there to do these kinds of things, because at times before that has been our problem. We had nowhere to actually do it.
Right.
And, you know, depending on what your needs were for the whatever the program was.
Right.
So it's very nice to know that now over at the State Museum, they could handle most anything we would want to do.
Beautiful space. And,
it really is.
Yeah. So let's talk about the program. This is the program that's going to be presented tomorrow?
Right. Okay. So tomorrow, 1 p.m. at the APK, I'm going to be talking about the floating churches of Southeast Alaska, and particularly the Presbyterian ones that I know about. The Princeton that sank in 1939 just outside of Auk Bay, and then a call went out for rebuilding the Princeton Hall. I mean, the Princeton, sorry, and a family named Hall donated money. And 12 months in the Sitka boathouse between the time that they started the boat and the time it was launched. Andrew Hope, Senior, was the master boat builder, and then several dozen of the teenagers at Sheldon Jackson College in their boat building class and their machine shop class and all day built the boat and popped it out of the boathouse 3 days before Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
And then the Navy came and seized the boat.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So, and then did it ever fulfill its intended function of being a floating church?
Yes, for about 20 years after coming back from the Navy, was a church boat, church bus, hospital ship, basketball team carrying thing for just about 20 years until 1963. And in that year, the same year as that they closed the Memorial Church, surplus the Princeton Hall, and my husband was the third owner.
Oh, okay. And then tell me more about the premise of this idea of floating churches. Why was that something that happened in Southeast Alaska, and what functions did they try
well,
to
fulfill? We're an archipelago, so
sure.
It's... you know, that's it's the way to get around. You know, not too many roads.
Right.
And some of the churches went to airplanes, but the churches that were involved in boats were the Presbyterians and the Lutherans. They had a boat called the Christian for about 20 years, and then the Catholics had. Father Hubbard designed an aluminum boat that they have out at the shrine that's looks like really much a one-person affair, maybe 20 feet long and only 4 or 5 feet wide. Just, you know, looked like a go-to places for
right.
for Father Hubbard.
Now, is the idea to be able to transport the clergy out to different remote areas, or is that sort of the main principle, or is it to, as you said, it was also these things were also used for community functions or getting basketball teams around or things like that as well?
Or hospitals. Princeton Hall carried a lot of people headed for hospitals. One of the first publications about this talked about the boats being able to carry. A message of mercy, comfort, and love. That was what the boats carried. You know, we are precious to God. We are created, and we are redeemable. I guess that's the message. And Walter Sobolev told me that he thought that the Christian message resonated particularly in the native people of this area because they were so familiar with the idea of substitutionary atonement. You know, they knew that they would take the punishment for a clan member. And then that seemed to make sense why Christ would take the punishment from us as humans. Anyway, Walter Sobolev said that the message resonated and this lasted. The boat ministry for the Presbyterians lasted about almost 50 years.
Wow. Well, it's a fascinating piece of history that I was unaware of. And to find out more, you can go tomorrow, 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock, over at the APK, the State Museum and Archives Building. It's all happening, and Kathy Ruddy will be speaking about the Princeton Hall and other examples of this idea of the floating churches in Southeast Alaska.
Well, and she has really a lot of information that she'll be presenting. So it's going to be a real good program and very interesting for people who have been here, you know, for quite some time and never knew that this existed, really.
Right.
And it's only those of us who have lived all our life here that have known about the Princeton Hall and a lot of other ships, too, that have been all over Southeast. For many, many reasons.
Yeah, it's a unique story and a fascinating story. Kathy and Marie, thanks so much for coming in and telling us about it, and have a wonderful program tomorrow, 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock tomorrow at the APK.
That's right.
All right.
All right, thanks so much.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
Gypsy flag.
Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. Been joined by April Resendez and Claire Geldof, who are here to talk a little bit about a Juneau Community Cafe on opioids. So welcome to both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And tell me a little bit about the idea behind this kind of meeting. It sounds like maybe it's kind of a little bit more of an informal meeting. Is that the idea behind the cafe idea?
Yeah, so the idea with a cafe is that you come together at tables, and it's kind of like musical tables. So there's different prompts and just big sheets of paper out on each section. And then the facilitator of this cafe will kind of prompt questions, and then you just talk amongst yourselves, and then just jotting down your ideas as they come up. So, and then they'll kind of, everyone stands up, and then you disperse out and go meet other people. So it's a really neat way to meet people from different trades and fields. I've done one of these before, talking about early child care in Juneau. So it's just a neat format to get out and meet people and kind of challenge yourself with really complex questions and breaking them down. So, yeah.
What sort of people are you hoping will attend this?
Anybody who has interest in this issue. So we expect people who have been working in the field, working in healthcare and substance treatment to come, but we'd love to hear from the community as well. This is really to hear what you see already happening around, whether it's official things happening or more grassroots stuff, things happening in neighborhoods and families, and also what people would like to see happen going forward. So
what are some of the kind of general topics, maybe an idea of like when people sit down at one of the tables, what are some of the things that people will be asked to think about or talk about?
I believe there's going to be 9 focus areas, and I don't know all 9 of them, but...
Come on!
Nothing organized by us. This is being hosted by the Office of Substance Misuse and Prevention, Addiction Prevention, and they're going to communities around the state. So coming into Juneau, they've asked us to help facilitate, but they really have the format behind it, and they've done this in other cities. But I know they're going to be looking at things like access to treatment, incarceration, prevention, that very earliest prevention. How do we make it so our kids don't end up using substances in the first place? So a whole broad range of things, and people don't have to be experts on it. They just have to have some thoughts on the different topic.
All are welcome.
Yeah. In this kind of crisis that we're all kind of recognizing as a national crisis that's been happening, are there things about Juneau that are unique to that you've seen or that you feel like is something that people in Juneau have to think about?
Well, I think just our sense of community here. I think we have a really awesome opportunity to come together. We are a closed community, so I think we have to accommodate what are the challenges that we're facing and the gaps that we see in service areas. We know that people aren't getting treatment support in the best ways possible, and that sometimes that means leaving town. So, again, I think that talking about what are the best efforts going forward here, what's going to help our families and our loved ones.
Is there a move afoot to, like, think about a more concentrated treatment facility or a more concentrated program so that maybe people wouldn't have to leave town if they're at certain stages of dealing with this?
You know, I think the format with this cafe is just to talk about broad topics as they relate to what should our community do with opioids and heroin, and just hear all levels of concern, all levels of support, like what's helping, what's not helping. And I think the structure of it will be really neat for people participating and just getting out and meeting. So we're hoping to have members from law enforcement, members from healthcare, individuals, families, people that have experienced this. So just to create a safe space to sit down and talk about opioids.
Yeah. So where is it happening?
It's going to be at the Elizabeth Paradovich Hall on Tuesday from 5 to 8.
Okay. And, yeah, so plenty of room.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of room for lots of people to participate in this. And tell me a little bit more about the group that's kind of going to be conducting it.
Yeah, so the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention, OSMAP for short, because that's kind of a mouthful.
With the state of Alaska.
Is with the state of Alaska under DHSS, and this is a newer group formed kind of out of that opioid disaster declaration the governor declared last year. And they are, so like I said, they're going community to community, holding these forums, these community cafes, with the goal of creating a statewide response plan, but also recognizing that every community has different levels of need, different resources, and the approach is going to be different in every community. So they're going to use all of this input to create a broad response plan, but they're also going to send back to us everything that's collected, all of the comments and opinions and thoughts that get collected and recorded next week. They'll compile and sort out and send it back to all of the participants. Anybody who comes can put their email address down and get that file, and it will also come back to the opioid work group and any other agencies that attend so that we can use that within our community to tailor that plan a little more.
And is the idea that this if there's consensus that's coming out of these various workshops, that maybe those become agenda items that could be followed through on?
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing you're going to be looking at are, like, what are the barriers? So if there's common barriers, is there something at the state level or something that we can look to other state successes to help overcome those barriers?
I see this also as an awesome opportunity to kind of keep apprised of what is going on. I mean, for April and I that work as nurses and kind of attend events that support this level of what are we doing with opioids, what are we doing to address substance misuse. So I see this as a really awesome opportunity if individuals are curious about what is happening, what can we do, what are we up to at work. So question and answer session as well to
yeah.
share that knowledge.
I mean, that's true. You are seeing these things on a daily basis. Many of us are kind of removed from it and feel like, well, maybe it's not that big of a deal or not that big of a problem. Obviously it is. And so it's a great opportunity, as you say, to have a kind of more casual atmosphere and a discussion-based approach to the
yep.
to the issue.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know about it. Once again, it's the Juneau Community Cafe on Opioids. It's happening Tuesday from 5 to 8 over at the Elizabeth Perestrovich Hall. And thanks so much, April and Claire, for coming in and letting
yeah,
us know about
you.
It.
Thank
All
you.
Right.
Take care.
Thank you. And that's it for today's Juneau Afternoon. Thanks, everyone. Have a great weekend.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay. K2